you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. What you're about to hear is Prester John by Devin Field. Devin is also the voice behind the Human Circus podcast, a show that explores medieval life. If you're not familiar with the Twilight Histories format, in these stories, you are the adventurer, just like in a game book or role-playing campaign. Think of a video game where you play a character exploring a world. In the Twilight Histories, you will travel to different dimensions and experience strange and exotic cultures that never existed in our timeline, all enhanced with music and sound effects. Before we launch into today's show, a quick thank you to our latest Patreon members: David Aslanian, Ethan Ritchie, Menno E., Jackson Frederick, and a thank you to Joanne Reynaud for increasing your pledge. This show is supported by patrons, and the funds go towards paying our podcasters, like Devin Field, who put in huge amounts of work to create these audio experiences for you. So to all our new patrons, thank you. And now, for today's show, Prester John by Devin Field.
Hello. It's good to see you. To put a face to the name. You know, your initial query kicked up quite a bit of chatter here around the building. Yes, it's nice to finally meet. Won't you come inside? Now, my office is just down that hall over there, but I hope you won't mind if we take the long way round and I play tour guide a little first. You see, we keep the odd artifact displayed along the walls here, and there are a few that I think you might be particularly taken by. All replicas, of course, but crafted with such exquisite exactitude, down to the composition of the material themselves, that the word replica, well, it starts to lose its meaning. Look at this, a composite bow. Belonging to a young Temujin, only then a boy by some culture's reckoning, and not yet known as Genghis Khan. It doesn't look like much in some ways. No decorative metals, minerals, or gems. Just wood and horn and sinews. Taken together, though, it's breathtaking. You want to grasp it, feel the horse beneath you pouring across the steppe. Your eyes on your prey, and the bow in your hand, pulled taut, and then released. It's simply magical, but then I can see that I don't need to tell you that. You can feel it for yourself. And this is another favorite of mine, a chessboard played upon by Timur himself. And yes, it does look different from the one we're used to, doesn't it? More board, for one thing. There's those extra spaces jutting out the sides. The citadels, they called them, where the kings or shahs alone could enter. More pieces, too. Not just knights, pawns, and bishops. See the camels, giraffes, and elephants. The war machines, viziers, and generals, all to be arranged in three rows aside at the start, and in a number of different possible positions. A fascinating game. Over there, you can see the mechanical clock organ that Queen Elizabeth of England had sent to the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed III. If we only had more time, I'd show you its inner workings, how beautifully it plays, and how its silver figures all come to life. The trumpeters sounding their horns, the birds fluttering their wings, the planets swirling into motion. It's really quite splendid. But that's not what we're here for. I wanted to show you something else. Something less visually impressive, but perhaps more important. Here we are, just over here. This seal. Do you know whose it is? No, of course not. It's the seal of Alexius Comnenus, the third emperor to sit in power at Greek Samarkand. And no, that's not something you missed in history class. You see, not every one of these artifacts is actually of our own timeline at all. Yes, now you see why I wanted to show you this. I thought you'd particularly like to see this one because you also want to see something to go somewhere that, so far as most people understand the word, did not exist. And I know, you don't need to convince me. True enough that in the minds of men and women, it was absolutely real enough, had more of an impact on its time than most of us who are more fully alive than in some fraudulent letter. I know that people in medieval Europe wrote and spoke of his existence out there beyond the Islamic caliphates, that they fondly wished for his armies to come and rescue them. Such a powerful dream, such a powerful lie. That of a benevolent lord from afar, maybe near the Mongol lands, maybe in India. Maybe Ethiopia. Someone who would sweep down and make everything right again. Would correct the losses of the Crusades. The bickering and bloodshed of petty kings. The sense that Christian society had lost its path. Believe me, I know what it is to be interested in the priest king. You wonder at the sheer idea of it, don't you? A great king and his kingdom, out there beyond the edges of the map. So elusive, yet holding such sway over events. Such power to shape men and their motives, and home to such strange things. Marvels, monsters, and miracles. I understand why you'd want to go. But still, the fact remains that you're asking to go somewhere that never was. Like stepping into a fairy tale, some might say. A finely wrought fairy tale of the Middle Ages. Fortunate for you, then, that in one timeline or another, everything, eventually, is. So yes, you'll find that despite the irregularities, your vacation is all arranged. If you're ready, we're ready. I have everything ready in my office. And here we are. Take these clothes and this satchel. You can change into them behind the curtain. I think you'll find them appropriate to the setting, though I must admit the nature of that setting leaves the specifics somewhat uncertain. The sword and the scabbard, though, that you may rely upon. And on that note, while you're changing, a gentle word of warning. You are on holiday, but you're not going to some kind of theme park. Remember that. I don't know exactly what you've read about your destination. Don't entirely know what to expect myself in order to warn you. But where you're going, it will not be the world of comfort you're used to. The context is loosely medieval, but not one governed by, well, anything, really. This is not like visiting any kingdom that existed in our timeline. There is very likely to be danger. And while I suspect that you delight in the strange, and this will very likely provide it to you in ample portions, it won't be that of a storybook. So be careful, or you might regret your choice in travel. It's not like choosing the wrong hotel, you know. Ah, all set? Good. You certainly look the part, and I hope I haven't put you off. It is my job to concern myself with such things, but I'm sure you'll have a great time. Truly, it will be the trip of a lifetime. Now, just step over here and close your eyes. It's usually easier that way. Close your eyes, and when you open them again, you'll be on vacation in the kingdom of Prester John. Happy travels. You open your eyes. You stand by a stream. It looks inviting. You slip your feet from their boots. Delight in the carpet of grass beneath them. Feel every blade bend under your skin. Breathe in. Exhale. The air is perfect. So clean. So untroubled by engines. A few more steps and you're in the water. Cold. Icy cold. You laugh with joy. Slip on the loose rocks, stumble, and splash down awkwardly into the stream. Sit there a moment, still laughing. What are you doing? Your head starts up at the voice. You'd been so caught up in the lovely scene of your arrival that you hadn't even looked to see if anyone was around you. You do so now. Nobody. What are you doing? You look up into the tree branches. A parrot? It is a parrot, in magnificent plumage of gold and blue, the one which appears to be shuffling about on what look like the five-toed feet of a human. You stare. A long tongue extends from its beak and twitches to life as it speaks. I see you've neither manners nor sense. First, you go tumbling about in the shallows like a giggling child, and now you just sit there and gawk. Continuing to mutter to itself, the parrot turns away in a great display of disinterest and moves off along the branch. Wait, you call out. What are you? Where are we? The parrot turns, puffs itself up on its toes. I am a parrot, declares, just as clearly as you are a roundhead. Ignoring that last part, you ask again, where are we? The parrot looks at you curiously now, or it seems to. Its head cocked to one side, eyes considering you more carefully. We are in the land of the Priest King, Prester John. You gasp in appreciation. So it had worked. You had known in theory that it would, of course, but to live it, to feel it, that was something else. The parrot is still looking at you. You ask it, do you have a name? Its long tongue flutters again. Obviously, yes. My name is Sebastian. And yours? You blink, caught off guard, make something up. You're not sure why. Bartholomew. Sebastian looks at you a moment. Well met, Bartholomew. I think, perhaps, that I shall see you again. With that, the parrot leaps into the sky. He wings briefly away, then wheels once around you and calls down. Shift yourself, Bartholomew. There are hooves on the wind, and you do not want to be found. Sebastian flaps his wings and is quickly gone from sight. Now you hear the hoofbeats yourself. Are you in danger? You have that sword and more than a slight interest in testing yourself with it, but you decide that you'd better see what you're dealing with first. Hastily now, with the sound closing in, you scramble from the water and conceal yourself behind a low bush. Soon, the horsemen come into your vision, flitting in and out of sight between trees, tricking your vision, surely. Or are they? They are. Centaurs. They come thundering closer, all muscular power, right up to where the horse's neck would be. And then there, a human torso and face. Or at least, nearly human. There is something to their features that is unlike any that you have ever seen. Something wild and unnegotiable. Still, you are on the point of leaping up to announce yourself when you see what they are carrying, slung across their backs. Those do look very much like humans, dead ones, some missing heads or limbs, some with their blood still running down the centaur's flanks. You shrink back deeper into the bushes and wait for them to ride through. breathe more normally again when they do. Wait while your hands stop shaking. Clearly, you will have to be careful. Despite the fright, you spend the afternoon wandering along the stream, eating from fruit trees, figs and pears, and settling into your new surroundings, tasting, touching, and smelling everything that this new world around you has to offer. Ever moving in the direction of an enormous hilltop castle off in the distance. But for the centaurs, you count your first day a tremendous success. You wake up in the morning, stiff from a night spent sleeping by the stream, gradually become aware of the sound as it gently burbles over the rocks. After a breakfast of more figs and some hard cheese that you find in your pouch, you give some thought to the day ahead. And to your holiday. What are you hoping for here? What are your plans and goals? What do you want? Of course, you know the answer already. For all the strange things this place is known for, and all the stories that surround it, it is the man at the middle of it all who fascinates you most. He is the Minotaur at the center of a labyrinth of deception. A fabricated figure who for a few hundred years tugged so many strings towards him. Fictional, but still powerful enough for a Mongol regent, quite aware that many Latin Christians still hoped for his coming, to specifically mention him in a letter to Louis IX. For someone who didn't exist, he had really been on everybody's minds. It's what had always fascinated you the most. You know he wasn't real, but enveloped in mystery, his power was, and you want to touch that mystery to find the core of that power, the spoke of the wheel. I want, you speak out loud, declaring your intentions to the world, to see the Priest King. I want to meet Prester John. Well, you should have just said so. You look around. Sebastian, you say to the parrot, what are you doing here? Well, says Sebastian, I wondered about you. Something about you just didn't seem to fit, and that's even more true of you than it is of the other roundheads that show up. The other roundheads? You're thinking of those bodies the centaurs were carrying. Oh, you know, says Sebastian, Genoans, Lombards, Baudolinos, they're all much the same. Coming by sea or by land, suffering shipwrecks or hellish desert crossings, and then all inevitably falling here, their bodies failing them. Not so very many, I suppose, but enough to form a pattern. Pilgrims come to see the Priest King. Think you can do any better? You look off towards the distant castle. A quest. Exactly what you dreamed of. You nod. Look at the parrot. What kind of a name for a parrot is Sebastian?
A common enough name for a parrot, he answers, hopping into flight.
Having made your choice, you follow after, doing what you'd always wanted, trailing a fleshy-footed, intelligent parrot on the path to Prester John's castle. For the first time in a long time, you are content. That optimism carries through into the next morning. You wake up hungry and already a little tired of figs, but then you catch the unmistakable aroma of cooking meat, carried on the wind, and spot the thin column of smoke a little ways off through the trees. There is a moment of trepidation. You again remember those corpses bouncing around on the backs of the centaurs. But then you look to Sebastian, and he just moves a wing slightly, as if to say, why not? Or so you choose to interpret it. You are hungry, after all. You head towards the smoke, picking your way through the woods until you come to a clearing. And in it, a man, sitting by the fire and stirring at the small pot which has produced such delicious smells. You're about to ask him if you might invite yourself for breakfast,
But then you see his face, and the words die in your throat. His body is unremarkable, but his mouth... There isn't a mouth, just the smallest opening where it should be. So small that at first you're not really sure it's there at all. Forgetting any sense of manners or politeness, you stare in interest. The seated figure stirs his pot again, and then fishes out something from his bag. Something slender and curved like a quill. Leaning forward, he takes the object in his mouth, points it down towards the pot, and inhales. Breathes out with every sign of satisfaction. Repeats the process twice more. And then sits back, like someone sliding away from the table after a full meal, a slight whistling noise escaping from his face. You're still staring. He looks up at you, gestures towards the pot, waves you forward. You hesitate. Sebastian's voice is at your ear. You might as well take it. He's already finished with it. That's how they eat. You enter the clearing, tentatively, and take a seat across from your host. Nodding to him in thanks, you reach for the pot, plunge your hand in, and scoop up some meat. Wince as it burns your fingers, and shovel it quickly into your mouth. It's delicious. You go back into the pot, ignoring the pain in your hand. Continue eating with great enthusiasm, and with little concern for the juices trickling down your chin and onto your clothes. Across from you, his unfamiliar features cannot disguise the look of fascinated revulsion on your host's face. You slow only slightly under his inspection, and finish the pot. Days pass, and you trek ever on. The enormous castle appears at times between hills, but somehow never seems to get all that much closer. Close enough once that you think you see large, bird-like creatures landing behind the battlements. Or maybe not so very close. You realize you're not so sure just how large they are. "What are those?" you ask Sebastian, nodding in their direction, your hands absurdly flapping by way of explanation. Your guide scarcely looks up from his grooming. "Griffins." "Oh." You follow another with your eyes as it comes to ground within the castle. "Is that Prester John's castle?" "No," Sebastian answers shortly. "Will we be going there?" "No," replies your guide. "Oh." The next day, you see that in any case, you could not have gone in that direction. The first you know of the barrier is the smell. Actually, that's not quite right. The first thing you notice is the changing terrain. Drier and stonier. The trees scrubbier and less frequent. The landscape taking on cracks and wrinkles, losing any semblance of lush green grass. Then you notice the smell. Burning. Burning, but unlike any burning smell you'd come across before. Ahead, the sky looks hazy, but Sebastian, keeping pace with you in a series of short flights, seems unconcerned. Reaching the crest of a hill, you see the source, lying between you and the Griffin's castle. Before you are tremendous fields of flame. You stare, your eyes adjusting to the smoke and glare. In the flames, you see something moving. Long, snake-like shapes. Large, twisting worms. Watching with astonishment and a little fear, you see them writhe about. And not like they're suffering in the throes of fiery death. They do not stop moving. In fact, you realize as you continue to watch, they produce. Small bundles periodically roll out to the edge of the fire. You see figures dart forward to collect them with metal tongs. And looking down, all along beside the fire, you see more of them, everywhere, laboring with similar bundles, heating them in cauldrons, unraveling them into... silk? What you're looking at is a full-scale center of production, with people working on cloth and all its stages of creation, right there in the heat. You see one carrying a completed tunic and then throwing it into the fire. You wait, watch, see them then fish it out, pristine, as if it had never felt the flames. You look back to those snaking shapes in the fire, and then over to Sebastian. "Salamanders," he says. You nod in acceptance. "Of course. Of course." The two of you strike off along the burning land, keeping it just to your right for a time, and then parting ways with it. The landscape seems to shift around you, more changeable than you'd expect from your travels. More unnatural, too. Morning finds you on the beach of a waterless sea, an ocean of sands ever shifting. You watch, fascinated, as it rolls up into the crests and troughs of waves, lashing irregularly into the shore. You find your feet pulled forward towards its spray. How would it feel to wade into these waves? But a sharp beak at your shoulder halts you in your tracks. Sebastian nods his beak to your right. You look over and see the skeletons, some clearly human, some less so, scattered all along the shoreline. You shudder. "No good comes of venturing in there," he says. "Never has. Better to wait for the fish to come to you." He nods down at the fish that has indeed just washed up before you, hops down, and tears into it with his beak. You consider what kind of fish there is that might survive in this environment. By afternoon, you found another strange feature of this land. A stream of stones flowing down into the sandy sea, a roaring, grinding mass of rocks scraping against one another, until they disappear among the sands. Boulders bubble up and smash against one another, great glacial things of granite coming together with a crash, and then falling away, down, back beneath the surface. You stand hypnotized by the sight, near deafened by the sound, confronted by this shocking display of raw power. Neither your feet nor any other part of you wants to move towards this. Eventually, you tug yourself free from its spell, turn to Sebastian, and signal to him with your hands, motioning as if to cross the river. He flaps his wings at you, questioningly. You shake your head. He turns, gestures back from the river, and flies off. When you catch up to him, he's a little away from the noise and perched atop a log, looking quite comfortable. "Well," you ask, "are we going around?" He makes a noise which, despite his beak, sounds very much like a snort. "There is no around," he answers. "At least not one that I can take you through. Just impassable mountains, some too high even for me. If I were alone, I'd simply fly over right here." He seems to say it a little smugly. You sigh. "So what now?" you ask. "Now we wait. We wait until the river stops." You stare at him blankly. He stares back. Seeing no room for discussion, you sit and you settle in to wait. All the while, very conscious that your time in this world is not without its limits. That your holiday, as with all things, will come to an end. After 2 days, the river stops, and at first, you don't even notice the incredible silence. The transition from noise to unnoise occurs, and you and Sebastian simply sit together in the quiet, waiting. Eventually, the parrot stirs. "We should go," he says. "The river won't stay still forever." You know better now than to question such statements. Together, You make your way back to the river, though you would not call it that now. It has indeed stalled. A thick dust still hangs in the air, though the gargantuan mite that had flung it there does so no longer. You pause for a moment by its banks, and then step very gingerly on, your foot resting on rock that, were it moving, would grind you down to nothing. But you try to forget that as you scramble forward. It's farther than you'd thought when it was in motion, and in your hurry, you stumble and fall, cracking your knee against unyielding stone, cutting open your pant leg and the skin below it, leaving thick, oozing gashes. Your breath comes ragged and short, and more than once, you think you hear the rumbling beginnings of rocky movement upstream. But no such beginnings come. And long as it seems to take, you reach the other side in safety. Sebastian is waiting with a look of what you take to be disgust on his features. Or is it something else? Not disinterest, certainly. It occurs to you to question what this parrot actually sees in you and your travels, and why he guides you. With the tourist's typical conceit, you had simply seen yourself as inherently interesting.
This is too slow.
Your companion's pronouncement comes out of nowhere. You look irritably up at him. Carry me then, you snap back. Not for the first time, feeling a little ridiculous for being upset at a brightly colored bird, and one on human feet no less. But he just cocks his head to the side.
Too slow, he repeats,
leaping into flight, calling back as he flaps off.
I'll find someone to carry you.
What? You shout after him, but he is too far away. You sink to the ground. For all your irritation with Sebastian, he has a point. The way has become slow and arduous. Your legs, they are failing. You glare in frustration at them, stretched out uselessly in front of you. Might as well take the moment to rest. You bring out a fruit you'd picked earlier, fresh from a tree. A long apple, Sebastian had called it, though you're pretty sure it's something closer to a banana. So it seems as you peel it, at least. But the taste, it is not much like a banana after all. You finish the fruit with little joy, and look in the direction Sebastian had flown, looking for some sign of him in the sky, idly wondering what you'll do if he doesn't come back. Your eyes sink shut. They open to find a face pressed close to yours.
Your horse is here.
It speaks, fills your vision, recedes. Something strange about how it had filled your vision. You blink blearily, rub your eyes, and peer up at the human figure above you. Let it come into focus. Blink again. There is no head. More eye rubbing, but it's not the light of the sun that sits above his shoulders which blinds you. There is still no head there.
I said, your horse is here.
You let your gaze wander down. Not a head, but a face. There on his chest, the features protruding from around his sternum, staring at you, big-eyed, and if you're being honest, big-nosed, bulbous, really. The look of the whole face is that of drawings of the man in the moon, rendered flesh, and the overall effect is supremely disquieting. As you gaze up, an arm attached to that moon flesh reaches down and taps you on the forehead.
I said, your horse is here.
You rub your forehead. Another voice behind you.
I told you he was slow.
You struggle up into a seated position. Look around. There are more of them, moving about you in odd, stiff-kneed angularity, moon-faced and headless, sliding sideways and then turning as if on a pivot, ever sidling up on something. You're so caught up in how they move that at first you pay no attention to where. Away, out of sight, past bushes and trees. Wait, you call, but they're gone. And then their name comes to you, Blemii, those delightful figures with faces on their chests. You've seen drawings of them in reproductions of the old manuscripts, but this is something else. You scramble to your feet, catch glimpses of them, disappearing from view.
A word of thanks would have been nice, says the parrot.
You glance back at him, distractedly, look around. You see the horse that the Blemii have indeed brought you. The words chestnut mare come to mind, though you're not sure they're applicable. Cautiously, you approach and pat it gently on the neck. It doesn't seem to mind your presence, nor when you swing yourself up into the saddle, your weight. You wonder if you can in fact ride a horse, but there's no time to worry. Sebastian is leaping into flight, calling over to you to do the same. You give a tentative little shout, more of a yelp really, and shift your hips forward. Your horse, whether by its own instigation or yours, starts into a trot. You hold tightly and try to adjust to its unfamiliar motion, feeling very much higher from the ground than you would have expected. Though the landscape now flows more swiftly, time seems somehow to move slower on the horse. Once the initial nervous tension passes, you relax into an exhausted stupor, letting this world's violent extremes wash over you as lush grasslands give way to desert, and so on to harsh, mountainous terrain. You relax, but you hurt. Your legs have ceased to carry you, but they haven't ceased to ache. Since you took to the saddle, they seem even worse. Sebastian calls a halt to the march around midday, and you all but fall from your horse, tumbling down beneath the branches of a tree, grateful for its shade. You lie there, flat on your back for a time, seeming to sink ever deeper into the ground. After a time, you drag yourself up into a seated position to lean back against the tree and survey your situation. You can look down on the surrounding fields. It's mostly long grasses, punctuated by some kind of wild flowers that you do not recognize, jagged bursts of deep lavender blue against the green. You take in the low, scraggly trees, their forms twisted, as if by some powerful force since past. You see some other plants too, ones whose forms seem to defy your eyes to make sense of them. Are they giant mushrooms? They seem to form oddly fleshy tables that jut up and into the sky. In time, your curiosity gets the better of you. Wincing at the pain in your legs, you pick your way down the hillside and down into the long grass. Now that you're level with them, you see that they are not quite flat like tables. They angle toward the sun. And with that realization comes another memory from the old manuscripts. Might it be that they are less like mushrooms than you'd thought? Might it be that they are rather more like feet? Despite the stiffness, you pick up the pace. You reach the closest one, part the grasses, and peer down, exhaling in satisfaction. It is what you'd thought, just what you'd imagined. These were the kinds of things you'd expected when you'd planned this vacation in the first place. The hell is your problem? You blink in surprise, stutter in the face of the aggressive form reclining on his back at your feet. I wanted to see what you were, you manage. He looks up at you in undisguised revulsion, entirely human, nakedly so, from head to waist. That normalcy then giving way to a single stout leg which sprouts up into the sky and widens into its solitary foot. That thing you'd taken for mushroom, providing it shade from the sun. You're a skiapod, aren't you? You ask in excitement. Or do you prefer the word monopod? The figure continues to look at you.
I prefer peace and quiet, but I'll settle for getting up and smacking you in the face. He rolls to a standing position with alarming quickness and ease, a chorus of abuse and insults rising from the other skiapods scattered about the field. You stumble backward. The sword at your side, entirely forgotten, you beat a hasty retreat up the hill from the belligerent skiapod who settles back down beneath his own shade, the outcry of his companions also diminishing in the distance behind you. You're pretty sure that Sebastian is shaking with silent laughter as you make your last panting steps up the hill and collapse back down next to the tree. There's a taste in your mouth, and it's beginning to edge ever closer to disappointment. A mood of gloom settles over you for the next 2 days, or is it more? You're starting to suspect that your sense of time is slipping somewhat in this place. A common enough occurrence when on holiday, you think, a little bitterly. What was it you'd wanted here anyways? A bit of adventure? Strange sights? There have certainly been those. The punishing nature of this little nature tour aside, it has been punctuated with moments when you felt your heart pumping in fear or excitement. And you've seen marvels of a kind that no other destination could have given you. And yet, your cup feels less than full. It is, in a way, a sensation you're familiar with. You've invested such hopes in travel before, let the anticipation build over the months leading up to your trip, only to find that, while you enjoy yourself, you're still the same person. Then no matter how distant your destination, you cannot escape from yourself. Why, unique as it may be, would this time be any different? Such is your mood as you crest the hill and see the fortified palace complex on the other side. Maybe this will make it different. Even at this distance, the sight is magnificent. Gleaming in the sun, magnificent. Like the whole thing is wrought of gems, magnificent. You look down on pillars, rippling in red and white stone. Up at towers, topped in something that burns too brightly in the light to look upon. Roofs of ebony, stairways of gold, and gates of ivory. A courtyard paved with onyx. Everywhere, as you get closer, embellished with jewels. And on the air, a sweet fragrance, smoke drifting on the wind from a series of stone bowls, each one maybe 20 feet across, and seemingly full of smoldering wood and herbs. Surely, this is a palace fit for the Priest King. Your horse is finding its way down the slope, Sebastian keeping pace in his usual leisurely way. You're feeling suddenly upbeat, enough so to offer him a quick, "Lovely, isn't it?" The only words you've spoken to him all day. He responds only with a slight, "Hmm." But it does little to lessen your pleasure in the sight before you. This is what you'd imagined you'd find. Not just unfriendly humanoids and equally hostile landscapes, but the legendary Christian Lord of the East. He who so many of his medieval co-religionists had thought would save them from foreign threats. Their rescuer and redeemer, a Christ come marching with sword and shield. Except that he hadn't existed. Not for them. So much more special for you then. You breathe in deep, savoring the moment, letting that feeling of uniqueness sit within you for a second or two. You're almost to the gates, when the horn sounds. To call it a horn does not really do it justice. It is a roaring blast of raw noise, as if the mountains themselves have filled their lungs and now voice their displeasure, their angry call to war. You are knocked back by the force of it, your senses scrambled, and your body sent reeling in the saddle as you clutch on to the reins, your horse skittering beneath you, for a moment almost sinking to its haunches before it finds its footing and stiffens, trembling, in the face of this thunderous gale. You look back for Sebastian, find him on the ground, almost burrowing in it, wings wrapped up about his head as if to ward off blows. He's turning towards you now, beak opening and closing, like he's trying to say something. And maybe he is. It's not clear now if the sound is still going, or if you've just been deafened by it. Either way, there's no knowing what he's trying to say, not until he leaps up onto the back of your horse and lashes it with a sudden, powerful kick. You cry out in surprise, hanging on tight as it starts up the hill at a gallop, seeking to escape its sudden attacker with nothing you can do to stop or slow it. You cry out again, now in frustration, as you are carried quickly off from the palace, over the hill and ever further away, even as the horn now ceases behind you, leaving only a dreadful, dull ringing. "What are you doing?" you're shouting to Sebastian, but you can scarcely hear it yourself. You very much doubt he can. "What are you doing?" you shout again. "Why did you do that? Why?" But Sebastian doesn't listen, or at least doesn't answer. He just drives your horse ever onward, ever further from the gates, from the source of that sound. And from the palace, new noises, shouts and calls, growing fainter behind you as you ride. Finally, he allows your horse to stop, and the three of you sit there, breathing heavily together. There is a low rumbling, building from the direction of the palace. Twisting in your saddle, you turn to face Sebastian. "What are you doing?" He's looking back. "We need to keep going." "What was that noise?" At first, there's no response as you continue to ride. Then, he begins to speak. "That was the sounding of the war horns. The kingdom goes to war." "But why are we running away?" you demand. "I want to see it." "No," Sebastian calmly responds. "We will not be going back. But if you must see it, then I will describe it for you. Through those gates, 14 kings ride out, clad in garments of gold, and with each one a great cross set with gems. 40,000 clerics advance before them, and as many mounted knights. There are 200,000 foot soldiers, countless horse or ox-drawn wagons of weapons and provisions. There are elephants and camels, and creatures you could not know." You listen, seeing in your mind the glisten of the sun upon so many thousand spears and suits of armor, the dust rising up until it totally envelops them, and you can see no longer. You shake your head. "Then why can't we go back to look at them? I want to see it." But Sebastian will not be moved.
"It would be far too dangerous. One does not watch the kings go to war. One only suffers it, or else escapes. They say there are no thieves in this land, and maybe that's true, but there are certainly forces that will snatch a life away and consume the body that held it. Among that kingly army are many that would do so. Some with horns on their head, some others that you would find less obviously monstrous."
"And Prester John, you ask? He goes with them? Or is he still in the palace? We could wait and go back to see him when the army has gone." But again, Sebastian will not allow it.
"He was never there, and that palace is not the priest king's. His personal realm contains those of 72 kings. That palace is only one of theirs. He would never dwell anywhere so simple."
He pauses while you digest this information.
"Besides, there's no guarantee that we could find the palace again."
You peer back at him, incredulous, as he continues.
"These are the shifting lands, and finding something again when you have once left it is not easy. I've been fortunate even to find you the few times I have done so. Maybe it is because these lands are still young, still taking shape. Maybe it will ever be so. Maybe it is the stories that mold it, the ones said to have brought it into being, and the ones told since.
There are some of the old ones who say we were spoken into being. But I don't know whether I believe that or not. You ride for the rest of the day in silence, wrapped up in your thoughts. Sebastian, perhaps the same, and maybe even your horse. This is a strange place. Something has been bothering you for a while now, and it's not just your growing sense of disillusionment. It's the question that had lurked at the back of your head, unacknowledged for some time now. With what your guide had told you yesterday, it had made itself known, unavoidably so. Sebastian, you tentatively begin, your horse making its way along the outskirts of a swamp. If these lands are always shifting, how do you know the way to Prester John? How do you know we're going the right way? A brief pause, and then your line of thought reaches its inevitable conclusion. Are we going the right way? We're going the only way, Sebastian replies, in an obvious huff. The path to reaching the Priest King is found by seeking him. So it has always been for those who have come this way, people like you. So it may always be. And so we are. Seeking him, I mean. He trails off with a little less certainty than he'd started. You ride a while longer in silence, your muddy surroundings mirroring your mood. And then you ask the question. You really don't want to. Don't want to have your suspicions confirmed. Don't want to think about what it means if they're true. But you must. You have to know. Sebastian, you say. Have you ever seen him? Have you met the Priest King? There is another long silence. And in this silence, everything is still possible. Have you seen him? You ask. Have you ever actually seen Prester John? Again, a pause. And then Sebastian answers. I have not. You sink back in the saddle, lightheaded, near physically sick. You don't ask any more questions. There is little now to say. The next day, how many has it been? You ride on, still in motion, but now aimless, without hope of reaching your goal. Now that you know the parrot has no more idea than you of where to go, you resist his attempts to herd you along his chosen path. You strike out in wild spurts in this direction or that, working your horse to exhaustion, and yourself too. You cross a river, then cut back and cross again. Find the landscape you'd just left, changed, different. You laugh yourself to tears, then set a new course, veer off it at a sudden sprint. Return, half expecting to hear unhinged laughter ahead. To sneak up behind and surprise yourself. But you don't. You just find more of this land's rapidly changing terrain. Its rocky valleys, its lush grasslands, its places less ordinary. By the time the sun sinks out of sight, your horse has slowed its pace considerably. It cannot manage any more, and nor can you. This world rolls slowly past, and you hardly see it. Hear Sebastian's constant presence, but do not speak to him. How much time do you have left? How long before your holiday is over? You hear the droning first, a building hum that starts small, but soon engulfs everything. Ah, you think. So that's how much time. You close your eyes as the transportation begins, and with resignation, you feel your vacation come to an end.
That was Prester John by Devin Field. It reminded me a bit of The Labyrinth, or something by Piers Anthony, perhaps The Dark Tower, but when the world was young. I love how Devin is able to weave his deep knowledge of medieval mythology into his stories, and in such a poetic way. Prester John, the king who, like a mirage, you always travel towards, but never reach. And along the way, all the magic and mythos of the medieval imagination coming vividly to life. Beautiful. If you haven't already, go check out Devin's past show called Khan of England. And of course, you have to check out his fantastic podcast, The Human Circus. If you'd like to hear more shows like this one from Devin, please consider joining us on Patreon. We've gathered together a great team, each podcaster being a talented storyteller, voice actor, and audio producer. It's a very rare combination, and to keep them going, we pay them from our Patreon account, which is generously supported by listeners like you. And supporting us is not charity. When you sign up, you will get access to over 50 shows, which you can download and listen to right away. Plus, you get monthly content, so it just keeps growing. We want to make supporting us as packed with value as we possibly can. One of our more recent patrons, Joanne, just wrote me this note, and I'll just tell you what it says here. Thank you so much for all your wonderful work on the Twilight Histories. I was an occasional fan for years, but I finally got a Patreon subscription last month because I wanted to hear more, and I'm so pleased. The voice acting and production values are first rate, and so far, I'm enjoying it immensely. Please consider supporting us. You can do so by visiting twilighthistories.com and following the link to Patreon. That's twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to The Twilight Histories. Till next time. Take care.